Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
Yo, what's going on, everybody? It's Monday night. You're listening to CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. What's going on, everybody? You know, last week we had our one-year anniversary show. And, you know, so this is our first show being 1 year old, I guess. And, you know, in the news recently, an unfortunate event. Leonard Peltier, who is, you know, subject of a massive international campaign to see this man free from U.S. prisons, was denied his denied parole, and you know, it's not until he will be, I think, 79, sometime in the 2020s, that he'll come back up for another parole. So we're gonna discuss this. We're gonna play a documentary, or rather, a speech by somebody who's heading up his defense campaign, a spokesperson for Leonard Peltier by the name of Ward Churchill. You know, Churchill is an outspoken critic of United States foreign policy and definitely colonialism against Native indigenous peoples. Churchill, you know, wrote a devastating critique of the United States in the wake of September 11th, simply answering the question that most pundits had, you know, watching the planes crash into the towers: why us? And so, you know, I'm not going to recapitulate everything he said, but he wrote this essay, and basically the University of Colorado ended up firing him because of it, and then there was a massive campaign against, you know, academic free speech. Churchill was eventually reinstated after, you know, a lengthy campaign that you know, cost him a lot of stress and probably financial resources. So we're going to play that clip, and I'm going to talk more about the case when we come back. So you're listening to CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
War, and the baby's crying, and the car here to elevate. I'll be floating in outer space now.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. We are back. That was Chaos in the Rain. It's a wicked track. I love that guitar. Okay, so we're going to play a lecture given by Ward Churchill, who is, you know, the spokesperson for Leonard Peltier, who is, you know, the subject of an international campaign to see him released. And this dates back, you know, this dates back really hundreds of years to, you know, the initial landing of colonizers on North America. And, you know, as the United States established itself and, you know, rid the land of Indians to make way for, you know, white settlers. I believe in 1890s, around then, you know, settlements had made it all the way out to the west and into Colorado and South Dakota, where there's a place called Wounded Knee, and, you know, there was a massacre of hundreds of people. And, you know, this isn't like, you know, 1600s, 1700s, 1890. We're talking about Canada was already established. There was, you know, United States had been around for almost 100 years, and they were still, you know, systematically killing the indigenous peoples. And, you know, that area had been subject to, you know, brutalization by the authorities in the United States government from, you know, the moment that colonizers got there up until today. And what happened was there was a shootout in 1975. You know, it's a very complicated story, but what happened was, you know, there was a shootout, and one native died, and two police officers who didn't identify themselves prior to shooting were killed. And to this day, it still remains a mystery. Even the prosecution that, you know, got Peltier locked up, even admits they don't know who did it. And, you know, a retrial, if they were to retry this thing, most people involved in the case back then believe that he would get out. So what I'm going to do is play this clip of Ward Churchill, who talks about, you know, the Peltier case. He talks about COINTELPRO, the United States operation against, you know, social movements such as the Black Panthers, such as different socialist and communist parties. And so I'm going to play this clip, and, you know, this is Ward Churchill elucidating a lot of these points.
This is the anniversary of the firefight that occurred at Oglala Village on the Pine Ridge Reservation, 1975, which, according to the official histories, two FBI agents were murdered by Leonard Peltier. They convened an investigation, unprecedented in its intensity in the history of the FBI, to investigate what they called the reservation murders, and that meant the two agents. Nobody ever investigated the death of Joe Stuntz, who was buried alongside another casualty of the counterinsurgency war that was conducted against the American Indian movement and traditional resistance of the Oglala Lakota on Pine Ridge Reservation during the mid-1970s, Anime Aquash. Both are buried on the Jumping Bull property where the firefight occurred. So before going further, I'd like to ask for a moment of silence in respect and memory of those two fatalities and the well over 60 other American Indian people who died during the course of that counterinsurgency campaign in 3-year period, 1973-76. We have to remember those who have struggled and sacrificed. We have to remember where it is we've come from in order to understand where it is that we find ourselves, where it is that we are. And only in understanding where we are can we plot a course to a better future for our coming generations. These things are connected, and it's that understanding that motivated Leonard, it has motivated others, and has to do with the formation of his case. Because Leonard Peltier is not simply a political prisoner, although he is that. Leonard is a prisoner of war. He is a prisoner of the longest ongoing war in this hemisphere, having at this point lasted a little over 500 years. That's 500 years of conquest, colonization, and genocide. It's also 500 years of consistent resistance on the part of those who were targeted for that. American Indians hold treaty relations with the federal government of the United States, 400 of them duly ratified by the Senate under the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, as well as under international law, as is reflected in the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. Treaty relations are compacts entered into only by co-equal sovereigns, that is, by fully sovereign nations. Every time the United States ratified a treaty with an American Indian people, it provided a formal recognition that the other party or parties to the treaty was a nation in its own right on an equal standing, entitled to the same rights as the federal government of the United States itself. So you have this recognition that there are nations other than the United States within the U.S. portion of the North American continent, all of which are subordinated directly to the presumed authority of the federal government of the United States for purposes of extracting their assets, their wealth, for the benefit of the dominant society to the detriment of the indigenous owners.
You're listening to Ward Churchill, you know, on CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. Unfortunately, I have to go to a commercial, but we're going to come back with this interview.
This is CHRY 105.5 FM.
And you have the catastrophic kinds of consequences to the people, to the population, that accrue from all such relationships. That's the nature of the set of circumstances that was confronted by the American Indian movement in the early 1970s, the most forcefully on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Because what it was that was being done was the assertion of the rights to sovereign control over lands, lives, and destiny that is inherent to the treated status of American Indian people and is inherent to the fundamental human rights of any people under extant international law. It's the assertion of those rights which precipitated the counterinsurgency war, which brought the repression down. And that takes us to the FBI and the function of the FBI, which, as any of you who grew up watching Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. be Inspector whatever his name was on the FBI on TV, you understand to be the preeminent law enforcement agency, the federal law enforcement agency in the United States, the preeminent investigative agency having to do with the rule of law, catching criminals, amassing evidence, providing it to prosecutors, furthering the due process and prosecution of those who are guilty of violations and seeing to it that they get their just deserts, that they serve prison sentences or whatever. That's the myth. And the myth predates the FBI TV series. It runs back virtually to the inception of the Bureau. Ultimately, it was an entity created right from the get-go to take the order of business as it encountered, business as usual, and preserve it. That the status quo, the structuration, socially, economically, and politically in the United States is such that there is a place assigned to everyone, at least by virtue of their membership in some rather arbitrarily defined groups. Groups like, oh, I don't know, blacks, Asians, South European immigrants, women, homosexuals, American Indians, Appalachian miners, and other poor whites. Name a group, there's a place. And the function of the Bureau is to make sure you stay in your place. And for people whose place is relatively privileged, that's a good thing. People who are not privileged in this social structuration tend to attempt to change the social structure and circumstance to better their lot. And that's what the FBI was created and developed and perfected to prevent. Now, remember, as we go through this, that the place assigned to American Indians is to serve as resource colonies internal to the United States so that there can be extraction of strategic and commercially valuable minerals and other things fueling the American economy while American Indians starve to death or freeze to death in the localities which they were consigned during the formation of the reservation period. And that's what it was, the American Indian movement, Leonard Peltier, the resistors on Pine Ridge, and others elsewhere were bent upon changing. When did this begin? Because you're always hearing, you know, there's some really nasty stuff going on. I mean, look at the Rodney King case. After all, there's the other case down there in New Orleans where the police were running this racketeering enterprise, shaking down and sometimes murdering tourists and drug dealers as well. And then there's this falsification of evidence in order to take drug dealers out of the community in Philadelphia while the police take over their drug distribution networks. And then there's the LAPD, and then there's the Chicago PD. And, you know, if things keep going on this way, we're going to end up in a police state. Well, maybe we want to interrogate this beast a little more to find out if we really have a need to be concerned that we're going to end up in a police state, as opposed to maybe at some point, and the question would be when, already got there. Instead of trying to prevent something, we need to be figuring out how to undo something, and it's a radically different project between those two things. Beer was started in 1913. It really gets on the map with what I call the slacker raids, and that was using the American Protective League coordinating its activities to run around and grab young men off the street, several thousand of them in one afternoon, to demand to know why they weren't in military uniform, demand proof that they had registered with Selective Service for the draft, and so forth. And that was the warm-up, okay? That was to see if the system worked for what they really had in mind. What they really had in mind was the Palmer raids that occurred a year later. And the Palmer raids were a roll-up, lock, stock, and barrel of the anarchist and anarcho-syndicalist movement that was quite pronounced in the United States at that time. You had approximately 15,000 people arrested overnight, all of them arrested on the basis of nothing other than that they were recent immigrants to the United States. They were held until they could be sifted out. What they were sifting them for was to find out if they had any sort of an affiliation to a radical organization in their old country, if they subscribed to an anarchist magazine, and so forth. And those that were found to have these kinds of alignments were considered undesirable on the face of it, no hearing required. They were all put on a boat and transshipped, not to the countries of their origin, but to Russia. Now, there were a few Russians on that, but you're talking Southern Italians, you're talking East Europeans of non-Russian origin, you're talking Greeks, you're talking a few Germans. All of them go to Russia, because by 1919, you've already had the Bolshevik Revolution, and we need to keep all these people in one place. This is a totally arbitrary, an obviously political maneuver. Theoretically, the FBI did not engage in much political activity thereafter for a period of almost 20 years. Theoretically, that's the way the standard histories read, but the standard histories don't read as consequential movements of, say, African American people. Because during the 1920s, the FBI's main focus was on something called the United Negro Improvement Association, and its leader, a Jamaica immigrant by the name of Marcus Garvey. And UNIA, well, had some things in common with the Black Panther Party, had some things in common with the Nation of Islam, had some things in common with several other organizations, but aside from having things in common with them, it had its own blend and happens to have been, to this day, the largest mass organization of black people in the United States history, ever. And Garvey was targeted for a technical stock manipulation, sent to maximum security prison in Atlanta, Georgia, and ultimately deported back to Jamaica, ended up in Africa, broke the back of UNIA, the organization came apart, and that was exactly what Hoover wanted, and had been wanting for a long period of time. 1918, there's a very interesting memo that's reproduced in one of the books that's available over here, COINTELPRO Papers. This is on first investigation by this young file clerk come anti-radical bureau head named J. Edgar Hoover, when he says, "We've conducted an investigation of Mr. Garvey and his activities, and unfortunately, we couldn't find that he's in violation of any law." So you expect him to go on to say, "We're going to wrap up the investigation." However, that's his word, not mine. However, if we continue the investigation, undoubtedly we'll eventually find something. And eventually, being 7 years later, they did find that technicality. That was a political targeting. The argument will be made when you bring that up, and a lot of other instances as well, that, well, Garvey did violate the law. So you may not like the severity of the dispensation of punishment, but by God, he violated the law, so he got what was coming to him. Well, There's a little principle, constitutionally speaking, in the United States that has to do with equity before the law. And yeah, on some peripheral technical charge, Marcus Garvey undoubtedly did engage in what would be stock fraud. Not that he pocketed any of the money. He simply spent the money on a business other than he offered the stock for, made the investment there. The stock offering was made for a company that was solvent. He put the money into an insolvent company. Okay? That's the nature of the offense. He went to prison for it. On the other hand, you got this other guy whose name may resonate. It was Joe Kennedy. Anybody ever heard of Joe Kennedy, father of a late president? Yeah, Joe Kennedy, whose manipulations of the stock market based on money that he had made being in consort with Meyer Lansky and other bootleggers in New York City led in large part, or significant part, or at least tangible part, to the collapse of the stock market in 1929. Now you're talking about engagement in fraud big time. And what was it they did to Joe? Well, they hired him in the Treasury Department to write laws to prevent people from doing what it was that he did, let him keep the money, and as a reward, when he was done drafting the legislation, made him the first Irish ambassador to the court of St. James. A little different from the punishment meted out to Marcus Garvey, wouldn't you say? The difference being, maybe a matter of complexion. You see, J. Edgar Hoover, aside from disliking radicals with a certain unadulterated intensity, had this little thing about skin tone and other physical characteristics that did not match his own, which is why he referred to Martin Luther King, for example, with a genteel nickname of the Burrhead. You can kind of get an idea of the mentality of the individual out of the language used. This, of course, is in private conversation. This was not for public consumption, but this is the guy who was dictating policy. The IWW trial was the largest mass trial in the history of the United States. 101 defendants, 101 convictions. Everybody who went to trial was convicted. Those who did not evade U.S. jurisdiction went to prison for it. What was it that they went to prison for? Sedition. And what was the sedition? Telling draft age men in the United States not to go to World War I. That's it. A land of free speech. Wasn't just the IWW, socialist movement as well. You got a socialist feminist from the Midwest by the name of Kate Richards O'Hare, who got a 5-year sentence for informing the women in an assembled audience at the University of Kansas that she considered them to be something more and have a fate more dignified than to serve as brood sows for the enrichment of war profiteers in service to the government of the United States. And I think that's a direct quote. That's what she said. That was a 5-year sentence. So that's something else we're living with today. You got a guy down here in San Jose, I think, who is going to trial on a hate crime for taking a sledgehammer and going up against a Columbus statue sometime in the recent past. Is that not true? Yeah. Yeah. You got a statue down there to a perpetrator of genocide, a Heinrich Himmler of the Americas. Somebody says that's inappropriate, take it down. They don't, takes direct action against it, and that becomes a hate crime. Well, interesting. If you start putting up statues of Hitler, understand you can't touch that because, after all, to do so would be manifesting, apparently, hate to Germans. No, it's hate to genocide. There's a difference, but not in U.S. jurisprudence. So they take these things and turn them around on political bases. Anybody that thinks you're going to get more laws passed in order to alleviate conditions, understand that every time you get a law passed by this government, this state, you feed into it, you validate it, and they end up using that thing against you. Yeah. Every single time. It's not to get more laws passed, it's to get the law off our backs. That's another way of saying it's not to reinforce the state structure. The state is not your friend. The point is to get the state off your back. But you got a second Red Scare that's often erroneously referred to as McCarthyism. And McCarthyism literally abolishes the left for a second time in the United States. You don't have to worry about anarchists anymore. They never, ever really recovered from what was done in 1919. I know you got a resurgence of anarchist thinking and anarchist sentiment in the last 10 years in the United States, but there is nothing on the scene right now resembling what it was prior to World War I, United States. If we got another 20 years of the kinds of growth of anarchist thought and sensibility in the United States that has been evident over the last 10 years. That is an entire generation worth. We might get back somewhere approximately the same point we're a century before. So it had this kind of impact. The IWW had 1 million members. And the things I'm talking about, you need to take a look at and compute in a certain way. And the way you need to compute them is that if the things I'm talking about hadn't been done, what would the face of this society look like now? How would the history of the United States have developed? If an anarcho-syndicalist movement with a highly developed political consciousness and an agenda and effective tactics not been obliterated by the mass trial of its leadership in 1919, but had ultimately evolved and grown according to its own dynamics and its own ability to articulate its message to the public at large, what would the nature of the U.S. labor movement have looked like? What would the work relations in American workplaces look like? How would it be different from the way it is now? I think you can probably connect those dots and trace it out in such a way as to understand things would be very, very different and in a very, very positive form from the way things are now. So these interventions are not simply moral wrongs or matters of historical interest, but things that have direct bearing on the quality of our lives as human beings interacting with one another, individually and as groups in the United States today. The second Red Square, when they drove Left Voice entirely out of the academy for virtually a generation, another set of costs and consequences. But in the aftermath of that is when you see the establishment of this thing called COINTELPRO. And what you have to understand about COINTELPRO is it's not really a disconnect at all from the sorts of things we've been talking about. Everything that becomes an element of COINTELPRO, everything that has to do with its goals and objectives and so forth, was already on the table. They've been doing it to organizations like the IWW and the immigrant anarchists. They've been doing it to the Communist Workers' Party and the Communist Party. They've been doing it to United Negro Improvement Association, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, various elements of the labor movement, Harry Bridges, and so on, all along. But they've been doing that on an individuated basis, on a case-by-case basis. And you had personnel that specialized in it, but they were kind of roving people. COINTELPRO, secret in its inception, made the whole thing centralized, coordinated, systematic, and applicable in a unified fashion at the discretion of the FBI director to any organization, any locality within the reach of the FBI. That hadn't been done before, and it was done in a period of absolute decline of the left. The left was gone. In fact, the FBI had to reinvent the Communist Party. They destroyed it. It was moribund. Such cadre as it had left were all underground and scattered into other countries even. The FBI had to actually reconstitute the CP in order to have a target to use as a laboratory for this coordinated effort. We had this standing joke back in the 60s when I first became active that you could always tell the FBI agent in the Communist Party because that was the only guy in the local chapter that would be paying dues. Okay? Right. But it got a little more than that. You see, some of those chapters were wholly composed of FBI infiltrators. All right? They didn't all know, you know, each of the infiltrators didn't know the other bros were infiltrators, so they were reporting on each other. All right? Sometimes that was a matter of inefficiency, but sometimes it was a matter of, well, we have to have tests and see what the accuracy of the information would be. Now, both parties to this are reporting on one another, and we know what each of them is doing. We can test a relative degree of accuracy of the informant information. See, what they're doing that in a social science fashion. Yeah. Just bizarre. But some of it isn't funny because you had still some active cadre who really thought they were communists. And the real communists were getting bad-jacketed by the infiltrators as being infiltrators themselves. Now, you got a couple cases, and I don't recall the names, and that's a disrespect, and I apologize both to the audience for not remembering the names, but more importantly to the people whose names I just forgot. You got a couple of bona fide communist cadres who end up getting bad-jacketed as being infiltrators and go off. I mean, their world's just been destroyed. So they destroy themselves. You got a couple suicides out of this. The FBI chalks these up as successes. By 1960, you got a full-bore counterintelligence program directed at the Puerto Rican independence movement. You got a full-bore counterintelligence program almost simultaneously harnessed to the task of destroying the Socialist Workers' Party. And about 6 months after that, you've got, although they'd never used the COINTELPRO acronym for it, a counterintelligence initiative directed against the civil rights movement in the South, particularly Martin Luther King.
This was the first half of a one-hour history of the FBI with Ward Churchill, recorded on the 26th anniversary of the firefight on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota that took place on June 26, 1975. Ward Churchill is a professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado, Boulder. His many books include Fantasies of the Master Race, Since Predator Came, and From a Native Son.
Don't even know what the death toll was in civil rights campaigns at the hands of entities like the White Knights, the Ku Klux Klan in northern Mississippi. It was a very violent period. And a lot of that was organic. That is to say, the Klan was real. It emerged from the Jim Crow cracker structure of Southern social relations, political interests, economic interests, and all the rest. It's not the Klan was a fiction or an invention of the FBI. It's the nature of the social arrangement in the Gothic South of the period. But not exclusively so. One of the prime axe handle wielders against the Freedom Riders in 1961, Jackson, Mississippi, was a guy by the name of Gary Francis Rowe. Gary Francis Rowe had been on the payroll of the FBI to penetrate, not actually the Mississippi Klan, he'd gone into the Alabama Klan. He was there as an act of solidarity in Jackson that day. Okay? He was also active in Birmingham. He was one of the guys who was beating people into a puddle. Meanwhile, FBI agents stand there taking notes as their guy, their infiltrator, makes his bones, renders himself credible to his colleagues, but being one of the most violent members of one of the most violent clans of the Klan in the entire South. This is the guy who appears to have provided the dynamite to dynamite Bob Chambliss to do the 16th Street Church bombing in Birmingham. This was an FBI infiltrator. I think the key to the whole thing and understanding how that operation was working, however, comes with the Mississippi Freedom Summer activities in 1964 when the Cheney Schwerner Goodman murders occur. Now, mistake was made there in a certain strategic sense, because when the White Knights, the sheriff, Philadelphia, Mississippi, and his deputy, Cecil Price, nailed these three civil rights workers, they probably were not aware that Schwerner's parents were well-connected members of the Lyndon Johnson Democratic Party apparatus. And when their son disappeared in Mississippi, they simply called the White House and they said, "Mickey's missing. Do something, Lyndon." And Lyndon called Hoover immediately after hanging up the phone with him and said, "Eddie, get some people down there and find this kid." And Hoover said what he usually said: "What's the matter, state right? We don't have jurisdiction. All we do is investigate. We're not law enforcement. We're really not, you know." And real interesting. Things can get done when somebody decides to get done. And the FBI's ineffectuality in solving certain crimes is belied by this fact. Lyndon Johnson heard him out and said, "You got 24 hours or I'm going to have the Navy in there." And Hoover thought he was bluffing. And Johnson sent the Navy in. You got all these swabbies dragging swamps trying to find these guys that are missing, and it's embarrassing as hell to Hoover because it's essentially telling the public that the FBI, with all its vaunted investigative expertise, can't be relied upon to solve a simple triple homicide in Klan country in rural Mississippi against a bunch of hicks. So he saturates the area next with Klansmen, and he goes after the Klan, kind of like you see in Mississippi Burning, which is a grand distortion, but they actually did use counterintelligence techniques, hammer and tong, against the White Knights. Why? Because this actually was an autonomous Klan entity, and it was operating on its own set of principles autonomously from the government. It was not under control, and it had just embarrassed the FBI, and so its autonomy was destroyed. According to the guy who ran this whole operation, William Sullivan, in his memoirs, within 3 months, they'd obliterated the entire Klan leadership structure, had them up on charges, which they could have done at any time in the recent past had they decided to make it a priority. But this time, since it was a priority, they got it done. And they infiltrated the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan with people on their payroll to about 50th percentile. Half the membership were active FBI informants within 3 months, including individuals that he said are at the upper levels of decision making. In other words, they took charge. That was the nature of the COINTELPRO. The outcome that they desired was to take it over, denied its autonomy, so that it could only engage in violent functions against the civil rights movements that were approved, approved targets, and so forth. 50 pages later in his book, I don't know whether he didn't have a good editor in the basement of the Bureau or what, but Sullivan says, you know, between 1964 and 1969, the Mississippi Klan committed over 300 bombings of civil rights targets in Mississippi. Now, let me see. If the FBI took over, as he says 50 pages earlier, the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in 1964, who actually carried out those 300 bombings? When you look at political repression, they're going to repress anybody that's upsetting their stability and their plans. And it really doesn't protect you to be a member of the Aryan Nation or the Aryan Brotherhood unless you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. But with right-wing organizations, the objective of an FBI counterintelligence operation is to put them under control, to use them as a counter in the counterintelligence operations they're conducting against those they really want to destroy. And those they really want to destroy happen to always be peoples of color and left-leaning organizations. Out of that experience, civil rights movement transforms itself into first black power movement and then black liberation movement. And the emblematic formation of the black liberation movement is the Black Panther Party. That's fairly well understood. The Black Panther Party ultimately accounts for about, it's a fairly small organization for all of its notoriety. Ultimately, its peak, 5,000 members, is proclaimed by J. Edgar Hoover to be the number one internal security threat to the United States by 1968. It's not 5,000 members yet at that point. Actually, the publicists who put out that statement on behalf of Hoover probably furthered Panther recruitment because people say, hey, number one security threat to the U.S., I'm going to join, man. Yeah. So you got a lot of recruits to the Panthers out of that, but the other part that wasn't so funny was the FBI really set out to destroy them, and they meant literally. So you got 28 dead Panthers in a very short period of time. You got city by city raids. You got destruction, infiltration at an unprecedented level. Provocateurs functioning at an unprecedented level. You got the framing of individuals like Geronimo Pratt, Geronimo G. Jaga, as he's now known, Daruba Bin Wadhad, a number of other of those who are considered by the FBI to be key activists, key agitators is another term used. And one of the reasons they were so effective during the late 1960s with this kind of thing is because nobody believed that they would do it. It wouldn't happen here. Well, guess what? I'm giving you chapter and verse and the fact that it did. It did. It's happened here over and over and over again. Every time someone or some group begins to become effective, galvanizing people. Ultimately, the most intensive of all these operations that were carried out was against the American Indian Movement because it had benefit ultimately of all the experience that was obtained during the 1960s against the civil rights movement, against the Klan, against the Puerto Ricanos, against everybody who was politically to the left of Attila the Hun, like I said. And the stakes that were involved in the issue, because ultimately you're talking about the territorial integrity of the United States when you talk about the decolonization of Native North America. It's not like the classic form of colonialism, like the French colonization of Algeria, where if decolonization is the nature of the struggle and the decolonization movement wins, well, the colonizers go home to France. If the decolonization struggle with respect to Native North America succeeds, where is it the colonizers are going to go? Yeah, you can see the magnitude of the issue. Hence, we go from counterintelligence to counterinsurgency, and rather than having 28 bodies in a couple of years, we end up with 69 that I can document, give a date of death to, and disposition of investigation on. Now, 69 bodies in the scale of things with regard to the violence that is exported on a daily basis by the United States may not sound like a lot, but let me frame it to you in another way. You got to deal with proportionality and scale. That's 69 people that were killed in a three-year period of time in a reservation area, the general population of which was 10,000 people at the time. Extrapolate that and you can make a comparison. That's a rate of death for political reasons virtually identical to that prevailed in Chile in the three-year aftermath of Pinochet's coup and overthrow of Salvador Allende.
You're listening to Ward Churchill on CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. What's coincidental about that analogy is that we're close to the the overthrow, the anniversary of the overthrow of Salvador Allende, which I think is about 36 years old now. We're going to go to commercial, and we're going to come back with the last segment of Churchill's lecture, where he talks more about Leonard Peltier and the massacre at Pine Ridge.
and that's generally considered to be a fascist reign of terror. Same exact set of circumstances, proportionally speaking, in the United States, although this is internal to the United States rather than external. The classic model of what operates in the third world is that the CIA presides over the enforcement apparatus of client regimes and organizes them into death squads, Mano Blanco or whatever. Okay, and they go out and do extra legal eradication of political opposition to maintain order and stability for U.S. corporate investment purposes and profitability thereof. Well, here, since it's considered domestic, that is to say the colonies are held internally rather than neo-colonies out there in the third world, the active agency was the FBI, the client regime was the tribal government, the Wilson regime on Pine Ridge, the enforcement apparatus was the Bureau of Indian Affairs Police and an entity called the Goons, and they functioned as death squads, and this was the result. It's virtually interchangeable in terms of its form, despite the fact that the actors and the specific nature of the ingredients alter. By the time June 26th happened, you had over 40 fatalities, and due process in effect had been attempted. Each one of these had been reported to the relevant police officials and to the Justice Department. In several of these cases, you had multiple eyewitnesses. Every time you had eyewitness to the crimes, the murders that had occurred, the shooters or the killers were identified as known members of what was called the Goon Squad, that is the death squad, that is the FBI-run mechanism of extra-legal enforcement on the reservation. There had been no prosecutions. There had been no indictments. There had been no serious investigations. So you have a situation that presented itself at that time. People had gotten the message. Either you stand down, you abandon your political resistance, you acquiesce in what it is that the authorities want to do with you, and that's to impound another eighth of the reservation at that point, because as we didn't know then, they discovered a uranium deposit on it, or you're going to have to provide for your own security, and that's what Northwest AIM Group, Peltier's formation of AIM, was doing in a Jumping Bull property at the time the FBI agents who were killed went there. And see, the FBI was undoubtedly frustrated as well. I mean, you got 40 fatalities in this closed environment. You got people who have been hammered. This is just the dead. During the same period of time, you got 342 really serious physical assaults that occur in that environment, almost exclusively directed at AIM members and supporters. So the level of violence is what the Assistant Attorney General of South Dakota, William Janklow, at the time called simply awesome. That's the reign of terror. Peltier and Northwest AIM Group were called to Oglala to defend a pair of elderly traditionals who were pursuing land rights of the Lakota at the time. They were targeted by these goon squads, and this was known. The FBI was frustrated because, despite sustaining this level of violence for a period of time, there was still the resistance. The movement's back wasn't broken, so they were looking to provoke an incident that would give them a pretext to bring in outright military force, as they had at Wounded Knee, but didn't really have a basis to do in the public mind just then. So they wanted to go there. They knew there was an AIM security group there. They expected to encounter eight people when they got there. In the event, they actually encountered 30, but the two agents were assigned to go in and instigate a firefight. There was overwhelming force deployed in the immediate area. More than 250 SWAT-trained personnel just happened to be on hand. So once the firing started, they were supposed to move in real quick, and in fact, they did, but not quick enough. And when they discovered that there was more firepower down in the valley where the two agents were than they'd anticipated, they all lay down in a ditch and waited for people to leave. The agents were killed. Firing dropped off. Stunts was hit by a sniper. The Indians exited the scene. Every Indian there except Joe Stunts got away, despite you had this massive number of FBI personnel attempting to surround him, which should have made the FBI look foolish. Okay? Well, they had their incident. There's no indication that the FBI intended their personnel to be killed. Okay? They were simply to get the firefight going, but that's what happened. They were killed, and since they were killed, they used that to their advantage as well. When you got the FBI director, Clarence Kelly, convening a press conference shortly thereafter. In fact, the morning after, an FBI PR specialist, propaganda specialist, who had been imported simply to handle the press that were barred from the scene, held a press conference. Between the two, they managed to say that the agents were killed by a group of AIM members who lured them into a sophisticated bunker complex, executed them with automatic weapons, having first disabled them by gunfire, dragging them from their cars, stripping them of their clothes, riddled them with bullets, and in one account, scalped them, nailed the scalps to a post, and took off. Well, The actuality was the agent claimed to be attempting to serve a warrant so they wouldn't have been lured. They were looking for a kid that they claimed was accused of kidnapping and aggravated assault, but was actually charged with the theft of a used pair of cowboy boots. It was utterly a pretext. You have 40 unsolved murders, but they're sending two agents chasing a teenager around the reservation over a pair of used cowboy boots. Okay. There were no bunkers. There were a couple of root cellars and tumble-down corrals, none of which had been used by firing pins, as the FBI's own personnel had discovered. They were in possession of the land by the time these statements were made, so they knew what was what. They knew each agent had been shot three times, which is not exactly riddled by automatic gunfire. In fact, they were pretty well aware that there had been no automatic weapons in possession of the Indians inside. Neither of the agents had been stripped, and neither of the agents had been scalped. It was from top to bottom a falsification designed to stimulate a public acceptance of what they were going to do next. And what they did next was send in overwhelming military force, 450 militarily equipped, using Huey helicopters, armored personnel carriers, wearing combat fatigues, and so on, agents to simply roll up the reservation. And at that point, they did manage to break the movement's resistance there. And the rest, as they say, is history. Although they could identify all 30 of the people that were down there, they charged not a single individual from Pine Ridge with having participated in the firefight. What they wanted to do was drive a wedge between the traditional resistance on the reservation and those people who come in to provide assistance on request from the American Indian Movement. So they charged only three outsiders and ultimately took them to trial. That was Leonard Peltier, Bob Robidoux, Dino Butler. Robidoux and Butler were apprehended first. Peltier had escaped into Canada. He was returned ultimately by the efforts of the RCMP, but at a date late enough that he was tried separately. At the first trial at Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the results are interesting. Because all of what I've been talking about in terms of the context of what was going on in Pine Ridge was admitted by the judge in testimony. The jury heard it. The jury heard it confirmed by the director of the FBI himself, which on direct interrogation by William Kunstler couldn't deny it. And all the rhetoric about what AIM was about, he also acknowledged they had no evidentiary basis to make the allegations, and so he withdrew them. The jury heard that as well. The jury heard Bob Robidoux say, basically, I shot both the agents, wounding them mortally, and under these conditions, I would do it again. And ultimately, the jury agreed. The jury said, yes, any reasonable person confronted with this situation, these kinds of actions by the agents on a day immersed in the entire context, reign of terror, counterinsurgency, repression, mounted by the FBI, would have conducted themselves in the same way, protecting themselves from armed aggression and protecting non-combatant people who were living with them in a tent village on the security compound as well.
And there you have it. That was Ward Churchill delivering a lecture on the nature and the history of COINTELPRO, of, you know, counter operative situations against, you know, leftist organizations, from, you know, communist and socialist parties to the Black Panther Party to Leonard Peltier. And, you know, just to reiterate, Peltier was just up for parole and he was denied again. So, that's that. You know, if you want to research more about Leonard Peltier in the case, just simply type Leonard Peltier's name in Google and you'll find, you know, his defense committee, you'll find things on Ward Churchill and other things of that nature. Right, and, you know, he's going to talk to us about an event that is coming up on the weekend. Steve, you're with us?
Good evening, Justin. How are you, brother?
I'm doing good. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing well. I just finished listening to the documentary with Ward Churchill on Radio Basic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, we can't get Ward on live. I haven't been able to contact him. He's an incredibly busy person. But, you know, hopefully in the near future.
Now, this documentary of Ward Churchill raises some questions, right?
Right.
What is the link, what is the relationship between the struggle of working class people and national liberation struggles?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the topic of an event that's going to be held this coming weekend in Toronto by the May 1st Movement Committee.
Right.
Of which Basics Free Community Newsletter is a member.
Mm-hmm.
So what we heard in that radio documentary with Ward Churchill was that in the history of the United States in the 20th century, the FBI has played a central role in crushing all national liberation struggles within the United States, so namely of American Indian,
mm-hmm.
of Indigenous peoples of the United States. And their affiliates and organizations that are on the left throughout the entire 20th century, from the, you know, the IWW, the International Workers of the World, to the Communist parties, to socialists, and so on and so forth. And so this is the question precisely is, what is the link between national liberation movement and the struggle of working class people? And that's actually the name of the event being held this weekend by the May 1st Movement Committee, which is National Liberation in Toronto Workers. Is there a connection? And the May 1st Movement is going to be holding this event at the offices of QP 4400 at that's St. Clair and Bathurst, 1482 St. Clair West, this Sunday, September 27th at 2:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And at that event, there's going to be speakers talking on behalf of the national liberation struggles in the Philippines, in Tamil Nadu, and in Colombia. And those are three countries in which, you know, Canada has a foreign policy towards.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a foreign policy that's benefiting the people or the majority of people in those countries.
No.
Sorry?
I was going to say, most of their relationship is trade agreements that, you know, reinforce the suppression of those national liberation movements.
That's right. That's right. So we recently observed a genocide in Sri Lanka against the Tamils,
mm-hmm.
of which the Canadian government expressed its indifference. And in fact, at one point even provided material aid to the government, to the genocidal government. We have Canada forming free trade agreements with Colombia, another genocidal fascist government, you know, crushing the struggles of workers and the struggles of peasants, especially in the countryside. And we also have Canada's foreign policy towards the Philippines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of which it has a particular labor agreement with. And it's under that agreement that we see, you know, thousands and thousands of Filipinas coming to Canada to work as living caregivers, right?
Right.
So there is a connection between the national liberation struggles of peoples both outside of the borders of Canada and the struggles of peoples for self-determination and potentially even national liberation within Canada's borders, and those struggles of working class people. These struggles are not in contradiction to one another, or nor do they have to be at odds with one another, but in fact they could potentially be allies and are in objective terms allies to one another. So this is these are the topics that are going to be explored at this event this coming weekend.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and you know, Churchill, you can only sort of touch the surface of a couple of them, and I've been to events like this, and it's amazing to hear like the actual people involved in the struggle give their narrative.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Mm-hmm. So again, that's St. Clair and Bathurst?
Yes, QP offices, 4400, it's on the northwest corner, that's 1482 St. Clair Avenue West, 2:30 p.m. this coming Sunday, September 27th. And the event is called National Liberation and Toronto Workers. Is there a connection? And when we see, you know, the recent, mobilizations of Tamil people in Toronto, the great majority of whom are working class people, you know, working in the backs of Toronto restaurants or wherever else, you know, we see definitely there's obviously a connection there between that section of Toronto's working class and, of course, that liberation movement that was and is continuing to develop in Sri Lanka for the people of Tamil Nadu.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely, Steve. No, that's good that you brought that to everyone's attention. Hopefully, you know, the listeners can make it out to that. Is there anything else that you want to add before we go, Steve?
Well, yeah, if people want more details about that event or to explore some of these topics in greater detail, I just encourage people to check out the Basics website, which for now continues to be basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com. We have a new website we're launching in a couple weeks, but for now, that's the website of Basics, and people can get more details about that event or anything that I said on that website.
Okay, all right, great, Steve. You know, thanks for the update, and I hope to see you and, you know, all of our listeners out there.
No doubt, man. Stay strong, live long.
All right, see you, brother.
All right.
That was, you know, Radio Basics' own Steve DeSilva. Steve occasionally hosts, and, you know, the May 1st committee, in conjunction with the other groups, we threw down a huge event last May 1st, a big worker celebration at the Steelworkers Hall, which was a great party. It, you know, even went far beyond my expectations. And, you know, again, that's Sunday. This Sunday at 2:30, the QP offices at St. Clair and Bathurst. And again, like you said, you know, basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com to check out the details of that event. So, you know, that's our show. I hope you got a lot of information about it, on it, and, you know, definitely search for Ward Churchill. I mean, if you've never heard of this guy, he will soon become one of your favorites. The man's, like, breadth of knowledge and, you know, his analysis of different issues is unparalleled, I think. So, again, that's it for me. CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
$30 in pay. The jailer got a tailor and the F-250. Standing on dirty acres, feeling goddamn filthy. Now it stands for years, suckers crawl for others. Understand the fears, I suffocate under covers. Cause somebody gets paid. Our lemons are simply beginnings. My sweeping the sugar in some crackers lemonade. Got my brother in Baghdad, hands pinching grenades. While we hustle out like niggas trying to buy chains. Back ass was for trying to buy change. I'ma walk through the valley and rally through my pain. I'ma wear your Confederate flag and be a rebel. Earnest wish they on Gretel with heavy metal. Careful for pissing on our hopes and esteem. Since as a youth, seen it scenic like they broken my dreams. Weave it together, I need all the yarn you can swing. From filthy farms, we learned about types of alarms we can ring. Are you gonna listen? It seems the only sense you got is vision. And since we shed our senses, now the senses steady slipping. And since we stopped our youth from praying, senselessness is living. And the rich don't really give a fuck cause they don't gotta live it. I see our living every day, you never paid a visit. To y'all the hoods of music, I mean truth we just exhibits. And truth we just some digits, a means to an end. By any means, I'm out, okay, why we gon' win? Since y'all won't listen, all the youth fist in place of my pen. So then maybe I'll shit on sink in.
Well, in the valley of death,
building
the pits it holds. Into the mountaintop, where streets are paved in gold.
God can put out our flame, until then we gon' face our pain.
And I know
God can put out our flame, until then we gon' stake our claim on these 30 acres.
Lord, I'm troubled, Lord, I'm troubled, Lord, I'm troubled all about my soul, my Lord. But when I get up in kingdom walk, I won't be troubled no more. Lord, I'm troubled, Lord, I'm troubled, Lord, I'm troubled all about my soul, my Lord. But when I get up in kingdom walk, I won't be troubled no more. She's gone, my well, Lord, but if